At this time, Columbia's Department of Talks presents the Honorable Frank Murphy, Governor of Michigan, who will speak on the subject of fair deal for labor. Governor Murphy is the third speaker in Columbia's current series of talks on the present labor situation. The first two having been Mr. John L. Lewis, chairman of the Committee on Industrial Organization, who spoke over the Columbia Network September 3rd on the subject, What the CIO Offers Labor, and Mr. William Green, president of the American Federation of Labor, who last week discussed objectives of the AF-LAVAL. CBS presents Governor Frank Murphy of Michigan.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The problem that immediately confronts our people today is one of reconstruction. The problem of restoring unity and material goodwill among the various groups and elements of our society so that business and employment will continue to flourish under just conditions in an atmosphere of peace and stability and confidence. It is related that when Abraham Lincoln lay murdered by an assassin's bullet, the leaders of his own party proceeded immediately to scuttle the policies he had formulated for the Reconstruction period. Within 8 hours after his body had turned cold, this extremist element, making no effort to conceal their contempt for what they called Lincoln's weakness, were debating ways and means of ridding the government of every vestige of Lincoln influence. Why, you ask, why this strange reaction to the liberal policy of conciliation that had come to dominate Lincoln's attitude toward the defeated Confederacy? Lincoln believed that fundamentally America, though still a divided house, was one national family. 4 years previously, he had closed his first inaugural address with patriotic and generous words, which showed his deep desire that the nation should not be rent by civil strife. We are not enemies, but friends, he said. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break the bonds of our affection. And now the armed conflict, which Lincoln had sought to prevent, was over. He labored with a charity so characteristic of his noble spirit to reunite the nation in the interest of its progress and happiness. But passion had already accomplished its deadly work and threatened to defeat his generous and enlightened purposes. It may seem strange that the savior of our Union and his earnest desire to heal the wounds of a strife-torn land should have been repudiated and reviled by his fellow countrymen. But actually, there's nothing strange or mystifying about it, for today we have in our midst something quite similar. Just as extremists of another kind have denounced the failure of government to employ force instead of first exhausting every means to conciliate hostile elements among our own people. It's a tragic feature of American industrial development that while we have demanded more and more efficiency in production and distribution, we still tolerate inefficiency of the most antiquated kind in the development of relations between workman and employer. We allow these relations to be governed by the stupid and futile rule of force, for which there is no particle of excuse in any enlightened society. To put it differently, in our haste to make more goods and bigger profits, we have forgotten to go ahead on the basis of a happy, contented, and harmonious people. That is the only basis on which we will ever truly stabilize business and make it flourish, as we hope and believe it will in the years to come. The motor strikes of last winter are now history. Much has been said about them and their implications for society and the future of the nation. Those in authority have been reviled for their failure to see that the law was strictly enforced. and perhaps some historians will perpetuate that criticism. But the clear and unassailable truth is that these strikes, perhaps unparalleled in the annals of American industry for the numbers of men and the material wealth involved, were brought to a conclusion through conference and negotiation with a minimum of physical conflict, with little damage to property, with no suppression of civil liberties, and without the loss of a single human life. Before the strike conferences were held, pessimists predicted that the giants of industry and labor could not be brought together, and even if they could, that they would never come to an agreement. We know what happened. We know that high officials of Chrysler and General Motors corporations sat for long and weary hours in conference with representatives of the striking workmen, that these able and intelligent men, after they were brought together in conference, arrived at an acceptable solution of a bitter industrial dispute that many people thought was insoluble without physical conflict. In this manner, which truly becomes an enlightened society, all industrial disputes can and should be concluded. Because the government of Michigan refused to employ force in blind and narrow adherence to the letter of the law, it has been said that government was debased in the eyes of the world, that the courts were flouted and the law ignored. But that is far from the truth. The government of Michigan believed then, as it does today, that obedience to the law and respect for authority are prerequisites to that social orderliness which it was striving peaceably to maintain. But at the same time, it was confronted by a situation that demanded realistic treatment to secure the confidence and obedience of many thousands of men under the strain of a conflict of such vast proportions and strong emotion, without causing disaffection and distrust for the institutions of popular government, required methods vastly different from those of a sheriff employs in dealing with an ordinary case of trespass. As a last resort, government may properly use and was prepared to use whatever force might be required to maintain its authority. But the government of Michigan was unwilling to employ force unnecessarily to dignify the law. In each case, it chose to place above a rigid and arbitrary insistence on legal formalities and respect for property rights, the duty to find, if possible, a peaceful and just solution of the controversy without sacrifice of human life or public authority. It is my conviction that this humane and courageous restraint in the use of force, while discussion and persuasion were producing peace without bloodshed and lasting rancor, eventually have strengthened rather than weakened government and the law. Better and more lasting results are often achieved by the application of moral pressure, an emphasis on moral and spiritual values, than by resort to physical force. Even though we proved in Michigan that the greatest of industrial disputes can be settled without violence, there are so-called practical-minded men who still contend that it is not practical to assume and too idealistic to hope that industry and labor can be brought together on a permanent, friendly basis. It may be idealistic, but I am more convinced each day that it is not only possible to bring them into agreement, but that by dealing fairly and equitably with both parties, government can win their cooperation in writing laws that will eliminate violence from industrial relations. Obviously, such laws will be of little value if they deny fundamental human rights or unduly hamper business and discourage enterprise. We must recognize the rights of property because they are fundamental in our democratic system. We must recognize the right of workmen to organize and to strike in order to secure for them the benefits of collective bargaining. We must recognize the rights of non-union men, as well as those of those with no union affiliation. We must insist upon respect for the courts and for other agencies of public authority. And always we must remember that the rights of the public are paramount to all others. It is self-evident, of course, that in writing and administering such laws, the federal, state, and local governments should not work at cross purposes. They should be in harmony, both as to objectives and as to methods. But as we evolve these new guarantees and protections, we should also strongly oppose and seek to prevent the development of such movements and organizations as the company-controlled union and vigilante groups. Where the former persists, it is undeniably a constant menace to effective labor organization and therefore to real collective bargaining. As such, it should be condemned. The activities of the vigilante groups, at their best, must be condemned as an assumption by private, unofficial bodies of prerogatives that belong solely to the state and organized society. Such groups, lacking responsible leadership, easily become instruments of bigotry and intolerance. It is imperative that progressive civic and industrial leaders see the danger in such activities and join with state and local governments in wiping out this thorn in the side of our society. It is equally important that organized labor renounce violent and illegal methods for the attainment of its objectives. Failure to do so will not only mean certain failure to obtain the public support that the labor movement deserves, but will impair confidence in the stability of business, undermine prosperity, and revive the dread specter of unemployment. Our task is essentially one of maintaining unity among the elements that have made America great. As Lincoln did before us, we must recognize that in spite of internal differences, we are still one people. But to keep our household at peace, we must not lose sight of the basic truth that material progress, however impressive it may be, is of little value when it is not accompanied by a corresponding gain in the physical and moral well-being of our people. Far more important, far more precious than material progress, is the dignity of human life. Today, the majority of our people have emerged from the black shadow of depression and glimpse again the sunlight of happiness and security. For many of them, the conditions under which they work and live are better than ever before. But this is not journey's end. Many others still live in dread of the insecurity that tomorrow may hold in store for them. That is why our mission of stabilizing and enriching life for all, not merely for a few, must go steadily forward. It is the noblest mission and the greatest task confronting America today, a task that calls for honest thinking, willing hearts, and the devotion of high purpose.
You have been listening to a talk on the subject of A Fair Deal for Labor by Governor Frank Murphy of Michigan, the third speaker in Columbia's current series of talks on the present labor situation. The first of these talks was given by Mr. John L. Lewis, and last week's speaker was Mr. William Green. Continuing Columbia's policy of bringing current social questions before the public, other speakers will be heard in this series from time to time on labor problems of the day. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.